I'm also, I wouldn't want to call myself a renegade physicist, but I'm also someone that has decided to do some work in neuroscience. I've been working in neuroscience for some years. And I'm going to try to make my talk a little bit self-contained, and also, since there are people that are not neuroscientists, I will try to give a little bit of a general introduction to the subject that will bore some of the experts here. I've done this work in collaboration with people at the Salk Institute. The principal actor in this thing has been Paul Tiesinger. He's been doing a lot of work in the subject. He actually did his PhD with me in physics, and then him and I decided to start working in neuroscience. And we were actually motivated by a paper by Yang and Bushaki in 96, and that got us into studying neuroscience problems. So, I made a mistake. One of the important things that people have known for many years is that there are synchronized oscillations in the brain. And these synchronized oscillations have been seen in many parts of the brain, in the olfactory system, in the visual cortex, in the hippocampus, and of course many of you know about this. So the question is that, of course, if you do an EEG in the brain, you notice that there are different types of oscillations that take place in the brain, that produce voltages that oscillate periodically in time. And people have tried to find out what is the relevance of the synchronized oscillations that occur in the brain, in particular in regard recently to a problem that's called the binding problem. The binding problem has to do with the fact that when we, for example, observe something like an apple, and we have to identify many characteristics of that apple to put it together and to decide that it's an apple, we have to look at the color, the shape, that we can think about this taste and different aspects and characteristics of that apple that are actually codified in different parts of the brain. So one of the important paradigms in neuroscience is to try to understand what's called the binding problem, and it's a lot of controversy in that, in trying to understand that problem. There is a whole issue of neuroscience along many papers that just deal with different ideas and different aspects of this binding problem. Now, I'm going to be a little bit repetitive with the synchronization in the next two slides. As I said, the synchronized oscillations occur in the nervous system. They are seen in EEGs, in endocrine field potential measurements. They look at them, they find them in single and multi-unit recordings in neurons. They appear in different frequency ranges. The frequency ranges that go from 0.5 hertz to 2, that's called delta, theta from 5 to 12 hertz, and the gamma oscillations that go between 30 and 80 hertz. And as I say, people would like to find out what is the relevance of these oscillations that people are able to measure experimentally. What do they have to do with behavioral states? What do they have to do with microscopically the neuromodulators that actually are responsible for the production of those, generation of those synchronized oscillations? So there's a lot of controversy. Some people say that the synchronized oscillations are important for brain functions, and some other people do not agree. We would like to think that they do have something to do with behavioral states. And we would like to know what is the relevance of those synchronized oscillations in the coding and processes that code information in the brain. What is the information coding that is related to the synchronized oscillations? I'm going to try to define what I mean by information. Of course, the mathematical definition of information that most people use is the only one that I know of, which is the one introduced by Shannon in the 1940s. And one would like to know what is the amount of information that is contained in these synchronized oscillations. If this information is useful for any brain process, is it possible for any neuron to extract some information, the postsynaptic neuron to extract information from these synchronized oscillations that get to a neuron? And the neurons have special properties that can process this information that arrives to each neuron by the connections that we already heard about synaptic and other type of information gets to the neurons. As I said, I'm going to be a little bit repetitive. The synchronizing oscillations is when the neurons fire, they have an action potential that fire more or less at a fixed frequency. This has been studied with mutual inhibition recently, as I said, by a paper by Wang and Bushaki in 96, and there was some theoretical and experimental papers, also theoretical paper by White, and they analyzed the different aspects, theoretical aspects of having inhibitory inputs coming into neurons. When we started to work on this thing, we added some internal noise to the neurons and tried to find out how stable was these synchronized oscillations producing mutual inhibitory neurons. Well, we looked at different aspects of this synchronization, when it's strong, when it's weak. When it's strong is when the synchronized spikings are precise in time, and when they are weak, they are almost precise, but not exactly exact. And what we have been looking at recently is the idea of having a set of interneurons, inhibitory neurons that are synchronized. They can synchronize by changing the neuromodulators that act on the interneurons, get the information gets out of this synchronized set of interneurons acting on a pyramidal neuron, and try to find out what is the amount of information that is being transferred by this set of a network or a cluster of synchronized interneurons acting on a pyramidal cell. What is the processing of the information that comes, what is the processing of information that comes from a set of a cluster of interneurons acting on a pyramidal neuron when this pyramidal neuron actually spikes, fires spikes after it gets acted on. Now, what we like to do is we like to take a realistic set of spikings from the set of interneurons acting on that pyramidal neuron. So how do we produce realistic spiking for the set of interneurons? What we do is we consider a set of inhibitory neurons that are described by the standard Hoshin-Huxley-like single compartment model. And what we do is we look at a cluster of interneurons, say 100, 500, 1,000 neurons. I won't get into the details as to how we actually simulate those new interneurons, but we wrote our own Fortran programs to do that. And what you get is that you get a rastogram, that is, this is, in this axis is time, and in this axis is the neuron, the number of the neuron, and each one of these dots that appears here is the spiking of that neuron at a given time. If we look at the distribution of spiking times in each one of these neurons as a function of time, and we look at the average over the spiking of the neurons for a given time, we get a distribution of spiking times for this cluster of interneurons. And what we get then is a distribution of spiking times for each one of these neurons. As I said, each one of these dots is one neuron, and this is the time. So you get a distribution of spikings by a cluster of interneurons. That distribution is not a delta function, but it has a certain width. That width of the spiking times is given by this variance, the inhibition width of the distribution. And this the width that appears here is called the jitter of spikings by the cluster of interneurons. In this case, what we have is that the spiking has a period of 25 milliseconds, that is in the gamma frequency range of oscillations, about 40 hertz. And we look at the number of spiking spikes per cycle. The cycle is 25 milliseconds. We look at the number of spikes per cycle, which we define as SPRE, and we look at how well defined is the spiking by the cluster of interneurons. And as I said, we're going to take these spikings that are produced by a set of physiologically defined set of neurons, interneurons, that are defined in terms of this Huxley model, where we use some of the parameters that are somewhat realistic, physiological parameters that are realistic to produce this type of response. So this is what we like to do. We like to look at a cluster of interneurons, inhibitory neurons. Each one of those neurons is going to spike at a certain time. Each one of these colonies for each one of those neurons in the cluster of interneurons. The period, again, is 25 milliseconds. That is in the gamma frequency range. Sometimes you don't have a spike. Sometimes you do have a spike. And what you do is that you get all the information from the spiking of all these clusters of interneurons. And what you get is a distribution of the number of spikes per period. And there is a width of this spiking that gives you this what is called jitter in the literature. And what you do is you look at the number of spikes per period of the driving of these cluster of interneurons for each one of these cycles, 25, 50, and 75. So you get all this information, okay, into this neuron. This neuron is also is a pyramidal neuron described also by Huxley model.
Excuse me, you assume the input neurons are already synchronized, is that right?
No, what you get is a set of neurons that are coupled to each other, and then you run the system, and they get synchronized, dynamically.
But the firing is stochastic. Sometimes they fire.
Yes, yes, yes. On average, they are spiking with this period of 25 milliseconds, but they don't. Not all of them do it exactly at the same time. So there's a certain uncertainty in whether they spike. So now you get all these spikes that are going to arrive at this neuron, the test neuron, the pyramidal neuron, okay? And they don't arrive at exactly the same time. There's a certain number of spikes that we'll get in a given cycle, n one number of spikes, n two number of spikes, n three number of spikes. And then what you're interested in is now you have this black box here, there's another neuron. How does that process that information? Because now that neuron is going to spike. And the way it's going to spike is that it's going to have, this is one neuron only, so it's going to spike at a certain time, with a certain phase here, in that same period, the next period, okay? And that is one phase, that is another phase. Phase delay with respect to the cycle time, period time. So if we look at what we have. I'm sorry? That's a dynamical jitter, right? I have a set of 100 or 1,000 neurons, and all of them are coupled by this Huxley inhibitory couplings, and then I run the dynamics and they're going to start spiking, and also they get synchronized close to this 40 hertz oscillation, but not all of them are spiking at the same time. So if I look at the distribution of ISI, the spike times, then that gives me the jitter, that gives me the width. Okay? And it is important because you get a neuron. A neuron is affected by, in the real brain, by many synapses, many connections that you have with the neuron. And all of them are receiving many spikes at the same time. But not all of them are happening at the same, exactly the same time. They have a certain uncertainty, and that uncertainty is called the jitter. Okay? I'm sorry?
The output neuron fires at every cycle.
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. This is a test neuron. Sometimes it's a test neuron. Sometimes it fires at that cycle, sometimes it doesn't. Okay? Now, what we look at is. I'm sorry? Yes, yes.
So, the definition of alpha neuron is that it does not feed back into this other
part. Right, right.
That's the definition.
Yes.
The only thing that distinguishes it from all the others.
From all the others, yes. Also, yes, that's correct. Also, it's an excitatory neuron. Mm-hmm. And.
This spike graph is a lot cleaner than anything you see in the real brain.
It looks like.
The spike graphs that you showed in the previous slide, they're much, much cleaner than what you see or real nouns, right? Even cross brother, I mean, that actually bear spot.
Could you wait and I'll show you experimental results where we did exactly this and you see you can compare? Because this is a talk where we actually did a theory and then we did the experiment. I didn't do the experiment, of course. Somebody did the experiment. Okay, so the question, and the big question that we want to ask is, how much of the information that is coming in from this cluster of inhibitory neurons that is arriving and to this pyramidal neuron is actually processed and used usefully, and I have to find what I mean by that, with respect to the output produced by this pyramidal neuron. Okay? So now what we have is we have a system where we have almost a periodic drive that is acting on this pyramidal neuron. The pyramidal neuron is a nonlinear oscillator. Okay, so sometimes when we have a periodic drive acting on a nonlinear oscillator, we can get a phenomenon that's called entrainment. This entrainment means that the pyramidal neuron is going to start oscillating with a period that is close to the drive period, even when you vary the strength of the drive. Okay? I'll show you in a second what that means. That entrainment, actually, was actually studied already recently in mathematical models of neurons in the physical Nagumo model by Longfine and Schialbo in 1998. It was studied experimentally, actually, by Hunter et al. At the University of Chicago. In fact, they have done experiments where one of the characteristics of driving a nonlinear oscillator that is producing something called somewhat sophisticated Arnold tongues have been measured experimentally in appletion neurons. Okay, and also people have studied integrated fire models that are driven by a periodic drive, and they have analyzed in some detail what characteristics are produced by one neuron that is driven by a periodic drive. Okay. What we want to do here, instead of looking at just the mathematical characteristics of this problem, we want to look at real, what is closer to realistic synaptic pulses produced by this cluster of inhibitory synaptic neurons. We want to look at what happens when we change the jitter, when we change the precision of the drive in the pyramidal neuron. And as I say, we want to consider one that is described by Hodgkin-Huxley model. Well, the first question that we have to ask, and this is an important question from the experimental point of view, is if we can get a neuron, a real biological neuron, to entrain to a periodic drive. Okay. What we are doing, and we're going to do experimentally, is we're going to try to find out if by having a conductance drive, or in the current drive, in a neuron, where we can actually vary experimentally, theoretically, the jitter, can we actually synchronize and train the pyramidal neuron to the external drive? Okay, and what one found is that we can indeed synchronize these neurons when this jitter divided by the cycle period is small, and when the number of spikes, this NRE that I defined before, is sufficiently large. Now let me be a little bit more specific. What do we mean by entrainment? And what we have here, we have a periodic drive that is coming out from this cluster of interneurons that is going to drive this pyramidal neuron. And this is the firing rate of a neuron, the pyramidal neuron, how often is it spiking, versus the current. This is a function of the applied current to the synapse. And here I show you what happens when a Hodgkin-Huxley neuron is driven by a current periodic drive. And what you have is that the firing rate as a function of this current is constant here, okay? It's constant there, it's constant there. So you have these steps that are produced by this periodic drive. And what do those steps mean? What those steps mean is that you're going to have the pyramidal neuron spiking in a synchronized way, for example, in a one-to-one ratio, that is, for each spike in a given cycle, you're going to get one output spike in the same cycle. If you are outside of the range where you have this step, which is here sub-threshold, nothing happens with respect to the spiking by the neuron. It doesn't spike. But when you get to a state, for example, the 1-1 log state, you get, look at, this is in milliseconds. You get, this is 25 spikes. When you get the firing pyramidal neuron spiking in cycle, in synchronized with the input. For each spike that comes in, you have a spike that goes out. Each spike that comes in, spike that goes out. Now, this is obtained when you get the Hutchings-Huxley model driven, as I say, by a current. But if you actually look at the realistic case where you get the cluster of interneurons spiking on a pyramidal neuron, the result is not as clear with the steps that it is here, but still you have this step, you have the 1-1 step there, you don't have all the steps in the middle, but you have the 2-1 step here. This is when you have a synaptic drive, there's a conductance drive. Yes?
And what is the special extent of this model?
Special extent?
You saw that going from current to conductance drive is more the biggest function. If you add the special extent, at some point you would.
Yes, I think that the reason you lose some of the steps that you have here is because here I have jitter. In this thing, I don't have jitter here. So I have just one pyramidal neuron, one Hutchings-Huxley model, driven with Hutchings-Huxley model, driven with a sinusoidal current. Right?
Single compartment.
Yes, single compartment.
Right.
Yes.
I'm wondering whether having multiple compartments will produce an additional smoothing effect.
Could be. Yes.
What determines the width of the plateau? The street between is very small.
I will describe that shortly. Yes. So what we want to do then is we want to see if, let me just get back to this thing. Let me get back to one more. Look. To this one. What we want to see is, again, if we have a cluster of interneurons that is synchronized to about 40 hertz, and it comes into this test neuron, what happens to the information, and I will define it in a second, that is being produced by this set of interneurons in their spiking, how is it processed by this neuron, and what amount of information do we get when we get outside, when the neuron is synchronized, is entrained, when it's in an entrainment step. Okay? So, what do we have? Now, this is a little bit of a clustered slide, but that's okay. Again, the same thing. We have a set of spikes that have a width, which is the inverse of the jitter. I'm saying the jitter of the input spiking into the pyramidal neuron. We have the number of spikes per cycle, which is going to be n sub I plus 1, n sub I plus 2. This produces a distribution of spiking, the number of spikes in each one of these cycles produced by this cluster of interneurons. Then we have an output. The output is when this pyramidal neuron spikes, and each time it spikes, it defines the phase displacement of the spike in respect to the period. And so we have a phase of phi I minus 1, phi and phi plus 1. So we have a distribution produced by the output phase spiking, the spiking of the output neuron. We have a distribution from the input, the number of spikes produced by the cluster of interneurons. And we could define the entropy, or the capacity of the input produced by the interneurons, call it S, which is just the distribution Pn log Pn, the standard Shannon definition. And we could define the entropy, or the capacity of the output of the produced by this pyramidal neuron, S of phi. Unfortunately, my slide doesn't show the phi and the n. But we could also look at the joint distribution. That will be a two-dimensional distribution that has two indices, Pn of phi. That is the distribution that is the multiplication of that distribution times that distribution, and we'll see that that is going to be an important distribution for what I'm going to describe, and it's going to be related to what is called the mutual information associated to the processes of the input and the output simultaneously. Okay? So the question again is how well can is pyramidal neuron transmit the information that is arriving from the spiking from the cluster of interneurons? Okay? So we want to look at the input, what is the number of presynaptic spikes that arrive to the pyramidal neuron, and we want to look at the output again. Now, the explicit mathematical definition of the mutual information is given in one of Shannon's and Weaver's papers. It's given by a sum of the entropy produced by the input of the interneuron spikes. And then this is a convolution here of the conditional probability distribution function of the Pn conditional with phi, log base 2 to get bytes, and Pn phi for the conditional probability distribution of n. Oh, thank you. Otherwise, it cannot be read. Yes, thank you. So we have to integrate over the distribution of the output phases, the distribution of the input phases, and then the p log p. But now this is a two-dimensional distribution function, not just the one-dimensional distribution function.
Question.
Yes.
Don't you have to assume that there's no input correlations? What if phi I is correlated with phi I plus 1?
Then I'm going to analyze that. I'm going to get to that. I mean, I'm just using at the moment the standard definition, and then I'm going to see what happens when I actually solve the dynamics and see how correlated they are in time. Yes, that's a good question. So just for the people, since these are physicists, I can write down equations. This is the equation that describes the Hodgkin-Huxley model that has the change. This is the memory potential, the change in time of the voltage. You have different currents, the sodium, potassium, and the Lee current, the synaptic current, the Poisson current, sometimes external current. And then this psi that appears here is related to the internal noise that is produced by the pyramidal neuron. Okay? So we have a jitter that is produced by the not precise spiking of the cluster of interneurons, but the pyramidal neuron can also have some internal noise produced by opening pores of incoming and outgoing neurotransmitters into the neuron. But you don't have to look at all these things. These are standard Hodgkin-Huxley problems with some complicated exponential parameters that appear there. So what is it what one finds when we solve this problem explicitly? Here we're looking at the pyramidal neuron that has been entrained in the 1-1 step. Those are the ones that I showed for the firing rate as a function of the current is in the 1-1 entrainment step. And here is the width of the distribution of the output phases of the spiking produced by the pyramidal neuron. And what you see is that the width, the step that appears in the drive of the pyramidal neuron is between these two points here. And what we see is that the width in the entrainment step of the distribution of spiking time phases of the output decreases in the entrainment step. So it becomes sharper. The distribution becomes sharper when you are in a entrainment step. Okay, so it becomes more precise than when you are outside of the entrainment step. If you look at the entropy associated to p phi log p phi of p phi, as a function, again, of the current, exactly where you have the entrainment step, you also get that the information contained in the phase of the spiking by the pyramidal neuron decreases. Now, this one may understand because, you see, when you have this entrainment step, you know a lot about how the pyramidal neuron is going to spike. When is it going to spike? So the more regular you are, the less information you have. As you know, the more ignorance is more information. But what happens when you look instead at the joint distribution of the mutual information? When you get large large amounts of mutual information. Well, if you have the input of the distribution of the number of spikes per cycle in the cluster of interneurons, you have large mutual information, you will get a sharper distribution. If you look at the projection along the n-axis of the PN phi that I showed you before, the jitter associated with the distribution would be smaller when you have large mutual information, and it would be larger when you have small mutual information. Okay? So this is what we find. What we find is that when you look at the mutual information in this step, where you get the step of the driven pyramidal neuron when it's entrained, you get that the mutual information increases rather than what happens with the regular entropy, which it decreases. So the mutual information increases. What does that mean? Okay. What that means is that actually the output phase, when the pyramidal neuron spikes, contains a lot of information of the input. Okay, remember that this mutual information is telling you something about the knowledge of the output about the input. Okay? So the mutual information does increase, and that means that there is something that is being transmitted, something that is being processed by this pyramidal neuron when you are in an entrainment step. Now, if I go through all the variables that we actually calculated around the entrainment step, first of all, you have that the width of the distribution of the output of spiking phases decreases. This is the black here. Then, if you look at the phi entropy, as I showed you before, it also decreases, and in fact, the entropy, the correlated entropy of the output. That is, if you look at how the phi I and phi I plus 1 phases of the pyramidal neuron spiking are related, it also decreases. The only thing that increases in the step, in one of those entrainment steps, is the mutual information. Okay? So I say the same thing here. This correlation between the spiking of the pyramidal neuron actually decrease when you are in an entrainment step. There is also, that once you know that the mutual information increases when you are in the step, you want to see how does that change when you actually change the number of spikes in the interneuron cluster spiking that gets to the pyramidal neuron. Here we are increasing this in logarithmic scale, the number of spikes per cycle, the average number of spikes per cycle, and we see that it's an optimal value for the increase of the mutual information. That is, if it is very small, the mutual information is small, and if it's very large, it's also small, but it has an optimum value where the mutual information is largest. Now, what happens when you add the intrinsic noise? That is, when you consider that the pyramidal neuron can also have some noise produced by all these processes of opening and closing, for example, of pores to neuromodulators. So what you have is that if you don't have noise, you have this maximum, as I showed you in the previous slide, but if you have noise, actually you get to saturate. Actually, the noise helps to increase the pyramidal neuron as a function of the width of the jitter, of the input jitter. If you look, however, at the mutual information as a function of D alone itself, it decreases. That is, the intrinsic noise present in the pyramidal neuron actually tends to decrease. If you vary that very little, actually, tends to decrease the amount of mutual information. The previous one? Okay.
So what you were showing the left-hand side is the mutual information as a function of the input
jitter.
In two cases, when you have zero, V, and when you have some.
Some, yes.
And what you showed in the right-hand side is a function of V when sigma is 1.
D when?
V.
Oh, for some fixed value, you mean for the sigma?
Yeah.
Maybe at the optimal value. I don't remember exactly, but I think it's maybe at the optimal value. I'm almost 90% sure.
But so I don't make sense of the relation between the two.
Here you have a fixed value of D,
yeah,
and the fixed value of D must be somewhat small here. Okay, and then you calculate the mutual information for a fixed value of D.
But the black line is for D equals
0? 0, yes.
So it looks like there is no point on the left graph for it.
Well, if I start varying the value of D going to 0, I'm going to get something that does like this. Right?
So you get interest.
Yes.
Whereas the function of D
decreases. Oh, I'm sorry. Are you saying when I decrease D, it should go up for a fixed value of this thing? So that would, you would get something here that would go from here to there. I don't remember. I think that this is this was done at the maximum, this was done also by a value of D. I have to look at the transparency. But the effect is that noise, internal noise seems to help this minimum that we got here when we decreased the jitter, okay? Whereas in this case, it just decreases for a fixed value of the jitter.
But presumably, as you increase the further, the whole red curve will then drop.
Could both drop, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Another question. So N and the phi, they are real numbers.
Yes.
So you actually can try to reason here only with some human resolution.
Yes.
And what is that resolution to use?
In time? In time?
Sorry?
We have different resolutions. I mean the resolution to evaluate the entropy. Right?
No, okay. So I guess phi is the screen number, right? It's number of spikes or it's the rate? Sorry, n is the number of spikes, right?
Yes, n is the number of spikes. Yes.
There's no problem. But
yes.
Phi is the period.
Yes. Modulus.
That's a real number.
Modulus is a period, yes.
Right? So when you calculate the entropy, you have to choose the final resolution.
Right. Right.
What that resolution compared to phi determines the sigma r.
We have to discretize the distribution Pn phi, okay? And we have to say what is the resolution that we're going to use there, okay? There are different types of values that enter there. First of all, we have, when we solve this problem, we have a mesh that we use to evaluate each one of these times for spiking of the output, okay? And what we do is, I think it's 0.01 of a millisecond. We have to use a bin size. For everything, we have to use a bin size. And we have to vary the bin size. In fact, the bin size that we use, we try to make a connection to the bin size that is used experimentally also. And then there are error bars, sampling errors, and there are many things that affect the values for the binning of this thing. And we have to vary just to get an optimal definition. I don't know if I understood your question, but that's...
Well, it's very small, right?
It's very small. Yeah, I think it's 0.01 of a millisecond, but I have to check that. So...
Just to follow up, so this is output, right? So if your resolution goes to zero, your output entropy should diverge to the
beginning. Why? No, I won't make it to zero, but why should it diverge? The entropy, yeah, well, let me get back, actually, let me just do this. Hold on. Let me get back to... here. Here. So this is the one they're referring to. No, but this is the one you're referring to, right? This is the entropy of the output.
Right, but this is for fixed resolution. I'm saying when the resolution goes to zero.
Well, you have some...
Your bin size goes to zero.
It may diverge.
It will diverge.
It may diverge, yes.
But the input entropy is finite because it's a number.
Right.
And the making is
With a jitter, right? The information that we evaluate here is P log P, right? And that converges, right? That has to converge.
What's the difference
Well, actually, well, I have to understand your question because I don't see the problem. I don't see why should it diverge?
Well, I'm just saying this is done with fixed resolution of insight.
Yes.
If you make smaller
insight,
this curve will shift down.
Every time you cut the resolution in half, you have one bit.
Yes, yes. I'm not sure about the fact that it diverges. I have to think about that. I'm not sure that why should it diverge. You could get that problem always then. If you every time that you make the resolution go to zero, you get that to diverge.
The fundamental
problem. Then yes, yes. So what's the problem? If it diverges when you change the resolution, then you didn't choose the right bin size. Anyway, so one of the conclusions, the main conclusions again, is that the output capacitor is the width of the distribution of the output spiking by the pyramidal neuron decreases when you are in entrainment. And that's important because it says that you are increasing, I mean, it's like coding information with some high precision. Did I lose one? No, yes, okay. So we have to look at the distribution. Now, look at how it looks like here. I mean, this is, you say an integer, but look at this distribution that we have here for n. And this is the width of that distribution that gives you the jitter. And then you have the width of the output distribution that gives you the width. And here we have the effect of looking at the n versus the phi, the number of spikes coming in per cycle with respect to the phase of the output. So we have a compromise of how to make this optimal with respect to the mutual information. So if we look at the jitter, we can increase the jitter to get higher input capacitor, but that reduces, we have to reduce it to maintain synchronization. And if you look at the output, that is the width of the output distribution of phases, then you have to increase it to get higher output capacity. That means output entropy. And you need to reduce it, however, to maintain synchronization. So you have to look at the different variables of what you need to do. This is the width of the distribution of, in n and phi, the number of spikings that take place prior to, I mean, by the cluster of interneurons with respect to the spiking produced by the pyramidal neuron. Okay. Now, what do we see here? What we see is, if we look at this plot, n versus phi, and this comes out of the calculations, is that you get almost a linear relationship between the increase between the jitter and the width of the output distribution. Okay? And that's the case. Let me see, did I lose? No. If that's the case, we can actually try to model this behavior of the linear relationship between the input, the number of inputs, and the phase by looking at a map that relates the difference between the average value of the phase with respect to the ith phase in the ith cycle with respect to the deviation of the number of spikes per cycle with respect to its mean value. So you will get a linear map that will be characterized by two parameters, some parameter that has the units of time, divided by time because this is time, and the alpha parameters, as well as if you actually plot this from the results and the calculation, then you get, you have a certain amount of noise that turns out to be actually Gaussianly distributed. So you will get at the variable delta phi i plus 1 versus the number of cycles, you get all these oscillations that appear here. And from the solution of the Hodgkin-Huxley equation, you can actually estimate the value of the parameters alpha and tau. And the difference between the black and the filled and the unfilled points are actually the relationship between solving this map explicitly or the results that you obtain from doing the Hodgkin-Huxley analysis. It's a random variable. So you have this map, which is going to be the relationship between delta I plus 1 and delta I.
So how do you generate that line? It's theoretical, right?
Yes.
How do you generate the line?
What you do is, I'm sorry?
Each successive point has to be just random.
For each distribution. You know, it is random, but for each, it's like with a random number generator, for each seed, I get a very precise value for the random number, right? This is the same thing. I run it for 1, and I get those numbers. If I run it again, I will get another set.
And the dots are actually integration functions that you want, right?
Yes. Yes. And we did this because we wanted to do some analytics, and we did, because we wanted to get an expression for these parameters that appear here to be able to do some analytic analysis of evaluating the distributions, which is actually what we did here. Okay, which it just tells you how the mutual entropy changes as a function of that tau parameter, the alpha parameter, and the width of the distribution of the noise that appears here. But that is, as I said, for the analysis. Let me just mention briefly, to some extent, what was done experimentally. Was done experimentally, they did some patch clamp experiments on prefrontal neurons and hippocampal neurons. The number that appears here is the number of spikes per cycle produced by what would be a cluster of interneurons. Of course, that cluster of interneuron spiking was injected to the neuron, and this spiking was produced by our calculations, the Hodgkin-Huxley calculations for the cluster of interneurons. So when you have two spikes per cycle, you have 20, and when you have 200, and this is the result of the spiking of the pyramidal neuron as produced by the input. This is the current, this is the voltage, this is the current, this is the voltage, this is the current. This is the current that we are injecting to the neuron. This is the voltage, the membrane potential. And what you can see, the distribution is very broad when the number of spikes of the incoming set of inhibitory interneurons acts on the pyramidal cell. When you increase the number, it becomes very sharp. That's what we would have. The input current is produced by our results. You see what I mean? We have the spiking of the set of interneurons, say 100, and we get the distribution of spiking times, and that is the current that is fed into the soma of the. Yes, yes. I mean, that's the way we mimic the effect of the synchronized interneurons. Okay, and again, experimentally, we find that the width, I mean, as you just saw, the width of the output of the distribution of phis decreases as a function of the number of spikes, normalized by 40 hertz in this case, because they are synchronized close to 40 hertz. The numbers that appear here are 1, 2, and 3 different neurons. This is for a hippocampal interneuron experiment. Again, you have the voltage, the memory voltage potential, and then this is the current that we inject. This is, it shouldn't be FRH, I think this should be the rastogram of the spiking of the neurons, incoming neurons. And what you get, again, is that if you look at the average number of spikes for the input as a function of the phase, you get the linear behavior, the one I just described before. Okay. Now, if you look at how the phases are related between cycles, you see you get this map that appears here. It's a map, a dynamical map between the I plus 1 and I, and you get a little blob that appears there. But the important thing, again, is the fact that experimentally, you do find this linear behavior between n and phi. And the width has to do with the number of trials done in the experiment. You can also look at the firing rate as a function of the number of spikes. And of course, here it increases. The output width of the distribution of spiking by the pyramidal neuron decreases. You can look at the mutual information produces a number of spikes in the incoming interneuron spiking. It just decreases here. The internal correlations are actually decreasing. And this is for the 1-1 entrainment step when you are away from the entrainment step, I think. And then you get something that is not linear, but something that is a little bit with more error bars and less well defined. So what is the conclusion of this thing that we have been doing? The first thing is that when you are in entrainment, the spike time of the output produced by the jitter of the output can be reduced and be smaller than the input for the jitter. We have also that the information in the spike phase is enhanced when you are in an entrainment step. If you look at the amount of information that is transmitted, of course, the regular information decreases and the mutual information increases. That doesn't mean that the information that is being transmitted by the pyramidal neuron, although it decreases, is not useful. Actually, maybe useful information transmitted by the pyramidal neuron. And we also looked at what happens when you have intrinsic noise, and we saw that the mutual information decreases as a function of noise. And these things were corroborated to some extent by the experiments. Of course, the experiments were designed so as to check explicitly what we have been looking at theoretically. And of course, you may want to ask if this is what actually happens in the regular brain. I mean, we have all these synchronized oscillations. We have all these things that all these different ranges of alpha, delta, beta, gamma oscillations. And the question is if they actually entrain the neurons. When the neurons get these spikes that are somewhat synchronized, do they actually become entrained or not? What we find is that if they are entrained, then what you have is that you have an increase of the mutual information, that is the amount of information known by the output due to the input. And we always get confused how to explain that. Okay? And that's it. Thank you.